It's you, it's me. This is YDT. I'm Nathan, and you're you. I'm glad to meet you here. And it is a show which pulls back the curtain, and I'm here to tell you about something amazing we're proud of, we're excited for, and that is the brand new store. My store. Yep, click in the description this moment. The Nathan Morris official store, talking in third person, is weird. But what isn't weird, you can get all kinds of really cool stuff, from socks, the sock game is on point, shirts, hoodies, holy shirts and pants, hats, all the stuff. I mean, even the hats, my 10-year-old approved, so it must be cool as hell. I would appreciate your support. Your support means so very much. Wherever it is, I meet you. I assure you, you are accepted, you are loved, you are honored. And thank you for checking out the store this very moment. Okay, enough of the plugging. Let's dive in to this episode. It's YDT, episode 191 of the Evil Die Trying, a show which pulls back the curtain and takes down these walls brick by brick and exposes the true hearts of those caring for those you love most. And it's great to step up and say, I'm going to do something great, or acknowledging the fact that something needs to be done, change needs to be made, moves need to be made, something along the lines of there's something great about acknowledging. Yes, it's even greater, however, when action is taken, as sometimes, oftentimes, words alone are not enough. It's important to show up. And not just with your words, it's important to show up with your actions. And enter The Unclaimed, a book, the first of its kind, the book, The Unclaimed. It touches a segment, a group, a topic, if you will, that's been largely forgotten, overlooked, turned upon. It's not a necessarily an intentional thing. It's not out of hate or disrespect, but it's lack of education, lack of a number of things. And it took two people, Pamela and Stefan, authors of The Unclaimed, it took them a number of years and works and research to really shed light upon and pull back this curtain, the curtain that I talk about, I try and have tried to do on my side and the topics in which I've touched. But The Unclaimed, it does a number, and I've been wholly inspired by, and I'm honored to speak to Stefan and Pamela with The Unclaimed, the writers of The Unclaimed. I hope you enjoy.
When we asked folks who were the legal next of kin why, what had happened, we heard a lot of tales of estrangement, of withered ties. The thing that I'll tell you that was most surprising to me, though, is who's not asked to claim. And that is that when it comes down to who's being asked to take on the disposition, it's going to be what the law decides is a legal next of kin. It doesn't look at the quality of the relationship. And we found a lot of people, and we write about some of them in the book, who have really close connections. You know, we write in detail in the book about a woman who was deeply invested in her church community, had a rich support system, but at the point that she died, the church community was rendered legally irrelevant. They wanted to claim her, but they didn't. And so the story that I told at the beginning is that's why it's so exceptional, so rare. They went to court, and there's a number of reasons why that was the case. A lot of it had to do with religious beliefs and really wanting to avoid cremation for that body. But it turns out that's just exceptionally rare. And I think a lot of Americans, at least when I'm talking to folks, this is one of the things that really resonates. Like, oh, well, I just didn't think a friend, a really good friend, couldn't claim you. And so when we think about the ways we live our lives, right, who we're spending our time with, that's not always the people who are legally connected to us.
Right. And Stefan, whenever Pamela brings this story and talks about sister, and so The Unclaimed in L.A., I would presume that is their form of disposition. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what did you learn and realize with this whole dynamic of, well, this individual is unclaimed, this family member may have not wanted to claim them, or another circumstance? What did you see from a faith-based or belief aspect with the cremation versus traditional burial?
So it works on two different ways. So the county is going to give you a standardized cremation. So they wait a number of days, give the family a chance to claim. If they don't claim, the bodies will be cremated and they will be stored in boxes. About 5,000-6,000, because they keep these boxes for 3 years. So this every year about 1,500 to 2,000. So you have to imagine a place with tons and tons of little brown boxes of cremains, while next to another 8 layers high.
And one of those is a human being, right? Like, yes, that is a person that, yes, is now in a box that sits there on a shelf. Yeah.
Exactly. And so then these boxes stay there for 3 years. Families have 3 years the chance to bring to retrieve those boxes or retrieve the cremains and organize their own funeral. If they don't, they will be put in a mass grave in December 3 years later. So that's when there's about 1,600 to 2,000 bodies cremated in one place. However, what's interesting from a fate perspective, so the entire process is standardized, but then at the moment of the burial, the county organizes an interfaith service. It's organized by a Catholic priest, Chris Ponette, who is the chaplain of the county hospital. And he invites other faith leaders, and they provide religiously relevant and appropriate send-off to these people. And it's actually a very moving and touching experience, but it might not correspond at all with what an individual wanted. So it's still, even though it's interfaith, it is standardized. So one of the other people we talk about in the book had very specific ideas of how he wanted to be buried, but he never articulated them or wrote them down or acted on them. And so he gets the generic burial. I mean, he gets a generic funeral that is not corresponding to what we know by doing our research he wanted to have done in his life.
When I think of impoverished poverty individuals, and that's what we think of with unclaimed, I'm a big advocate for mental health awareness. I would assume, but you know what that does sometimes, but that those with mental health challenges that find themselves maybe homeless or are veterans, perhaps drug addicts, if you will, that have suffered from addiction. Is that what, Pamela, you found and through your research as well, that this segment of people too?
So what you're asking is a very, you know, a common question that we get. A lot of people would think, and, you know, going into the book, you might have this assumption, well, okay, so the unclaimed are the homeless deaths, the people who die on the streets, right? The people who had mental health struggles. And certainly we find people with those struggles in the registers of people going unclaimed in LA. But many, many more people who are homeless, who are struggling with mental illness, who've had drug addictions are claimed. So it's not a simple causal explanation, right? There's something else going on as we sought to sort of explain and unpack in the book. You know, you mentioned veterans, and so I just wanted to draw attention that, yeah, we have in LA County every week about 4 unclaimed veterans. And often these are veterans who have struggled in some way, especially if we think about what happened after Vietnam and the struggles that a lot of veterans faced in mental health struggles, PTSD. And so what's unique about Los Angeles, and this is part of a growing movement that we find across the country, but it's, you know, we write about Los Angeles and what they do, is that every Wednesday, the coroner of LA transports by van those 4 bodies to Riverside National Cemetery, which is the closest national cemetery still holding full military funerals. And there's a group of veterans and their supporters who come out and play the role of surrogate family. And they actually say this as they bestow honors on these unclaimed veterans. And they recognize in the ceremonies, you know, and there's, you know, a little eulogy every week, and they recognize that there are a lot of veterans who are struggling with mental health issues, with drug and addictions. But what they say, and I love this, is it doesn't matter what happened in life. at the moment of burial, they deserve full honors. They deserve dignity in death. And so that's what motivates these 50 or so people to show up every Wednesday, like clockwork, at that military cemetery to provide those honors. So I like that as a kind of counter, right, to this, the sadder story. There's this really great light that is the people who are stepping up to do something for the unclaimed. And we write about them at great detail in the book.
You touch on, and I say this all the time, I don't care if you have much, I don't care if you have little, you are worthy to be loved in life and loved and celebrated in death. And I really genuinely believe that. And in death, and unfortunately, to celebrate, there is this aspect of cost. Things have costs, such as operating of a crematory. Stefan, do you, in the research that you and Pamela have done, I know that you did all this research for the unclaimed. Did you speak with or talk to the coroner's office in the way in which they cooperate, maybe perhaps with a funeral professional or the profession in and of itself, to pay tribute to these unclaimed loved ones?
I think this might be different from the situation you described in Kentucky, where the county sort of goes from funeral to funeral home and sort of spreads the burden around. What we found in LA was sort of more the opposite situation, where if a funeral home was left with clay, with remains, even bodies or cremains that were not picked up, they would transfer them to the county. And so basically the government took off some of the burdens of dealing with these left behind bodies from families, you know, in funeral homes. And the way that the medical examiner described itself to us was that they are the funeral home of last resort. So when nothing else pans out, they're going to have to step in. And so the way that we see it is that that we describe in the book is that the funeral home industry depends on the county to sort of to lighten that burden, which is different from the way you described it at the beginning, at the way that it works in Kentucky, where the county depends on the funeral home. So here in LA, it seems to be the more the other way around.
Do you see ever with unclaimed loved ones, perhaps a lack of education? And what I mean by that is the families. I've had families, people on TikTok, social media across the world would ask questions like, I didn't know that funerals cost money. I didn't know that I had an option. And so you have the byproduct would be someone, oddly enough, who could maybe perhaps fall through the cracks and be unclaimed. Have you seen any of that, Pamela, by chance?
Yeah, so we have one story that immediately comes to mind of a woman who I knocked on the door, and her brother had been cremated by the county. And I asked, you know, hey, what happened? Why did your brother go unclaimed? And she said, well, you know what? All of us siblings have taken care of our pre-needs, and he didn't. So I knew that if I left him, the county would cremate him, and then I could go back later and reclaim his ashes for a pretty low fee. And so to her, she used the county, at least strategically, as a low-cost crematorium, right? And so she did go and get her brother's ashes. She showed them to me, so I can confirm she had them. And yeah, I mean, that's an instance where somebody just sort of said, I mean, this is a very American thing, right? Everyone's responsible for their own burial, taking care of it while they're still alive. So that's one example that kind of comes to mind immediately for me.
I think a lack of education is an issue because many people are not really thinking about it. And that's why organizing a funeral is often an unexpected event. But what we heard from the medical examiner's office and from the other offices that we interacted with is that they try to educate relatives on low-cost funerals, low-cost crematoriums. And in some communities, there is an entire social network, some ethnic communities in Los Angeles, there's an entire network that jumps into action in order to raise funds for a funeral. And people do car washes. They may sell even candy in order to get the money together, and everyone chips in. So the cost story, it's complicated. we had one scene investigator telling us, if you really, really want to organize a funeral, cost is not going to stop you. There's a way to do this and to figure it out. But you need to get to the point that you really, really need to want to do this. And so that's, again, where the estrangement creates a really strong barrier. If you haven't had a relationship with Uncle Joe for 20 years, are you going to go and do wash cars in order to pay for his funeral? It's a big, big ask. So, you know, there's the number of unclaimed, it's a logical outcome of the long-term kind of relationships and social ties that people have had. And as we said, it's complicated by the fact that the state only recognizes the legal next of kin and doesn't look at the quality of the relationship of the of anybody who could be organizing a funeral, but has never even been asked because they're not the legal next of kin.
Well, the unclaimed are really kind of fall under the California state law. In terms of determining who would be responsible for the obligation. And so different counties in California kind of handle this differently, whether somebody is cremated, whether somebody is buried. I mean, so in some ways, Los Angeles is a better case than other counties in California. Some California counties that will cremate and then spread the ashes at sea. And they're actually quite proud of this. And then so on one level, you think, oh, okay, well, there's a ceremony. But actually, there's something about that to me that just, it unsettles me because it means that there's a finality to which there's not those 3 years to come back for a family member who maybe does want to put together the $385 claim fee or who it just took time to, for the county to be able to reach or to find out that their loved one had died, right? So And so in that sense, it's really by a county to county basis, although the law is a state law. I mean, there's no federal law handling
that. I think that we would definitely reduce the number of unclaimed if we took the quality of the relationship into account. And if we made it easier for non-kin or even remote kin to claim who had close ties. Actually, one of the things that I was really surprised with in our research is how many people have a good, relatively good relationship with ex-partners, like ex-spouses. And in some of these cases, the former wife or the former husband might have been able to come up, but because that tie is legally severe, they're not even asked. They're just used as a source of information to go to the real next of kin. So if you thought about if you think about how can we change this, one of the steps to take is to expand the notion of who qualifies as the kin that can make a decision about a funeral. And we see some precedents of that in end-of-life decision-making. You know, if you're talking about taking somebody off a ventilator, it's not just the legal next of kin who makes that decision. It's a family gathering. It's an entire group of relatives that has to come on the same page. So there's different ways of already at the end of life that we are dealing with this situation. But in disposition, it's pretty narrowly defined. There's like a number of boxes, and you go to the when you hit the first person in the box, that's it. That's the legal next of kin.
I wonder, are anyone making strides to change law? Because I think you're right. I feel because in Kentucky, we do not recognize common law marriage. However, I can think of multiple handfuls of situations where things would have been taken care of. And the loved one would have gotten the service in which that they had perhaps requested.
I know that there are some movements building when it comes to thinking about foster care system, that we sort of change our notions of who's kind of legal family that could come and step in and take over care of a child. There's been a lot of work on terms of LGBTQ rights and sort of expanding notions, legal definitions of kin in that respect. There isn't, to my knowledge, yet a clear organization, one organization that you can go to if this is what you're, you know, trying to do. However, Stefan and I, we've created a website for the book, theunclaimedbook.com, and we're starting to put together and we're starting to collect stories from people who are interested, people who are reaching out to us through there. We have on there a list of, you know, tips for getting involved. And one of those is to think about, you know, how would we change the law? And where are the organizations that we can kind of bring folks together on? So we're hoping to get more folks interested with us in doing that very thing.
We are one of the, this is the first book on the unclaimed. Almost nobody has paid any attention to, it's been an invisible population, but it's been growing and the numbers have been growing. So I think there is definitely a demand for changing the law, but we're still at the early stages. But part of the reason of writing this book is to generate some interest in people to think about why are we just designating somebody based on a biological or legal tie to take care of this cost of funeral while this might not be the right person to ask.
I have seen in the past few years with social media, who would have ever thought that people would be coming in droves for the musician mortician? This video goes viral because people were intrigued by me opening the door to the care center, allowing people, 18-year-olds in high school, a tour and given an opportunity and speaking to them at their level on why we do what we do and what happens behind the closed door. And for a couple of years, I mean, we've all been moved, especially by this pandemic, that we've all lost someone or something in droves. It's almost affording, I feel, an opportunity now, and you all might be seeing it too, where people are raising their eyebrows and wondering, well, what happens? Why? And forever, I feel people have thought death is maybe voluntary, and it's not one thing that anybody has wanted to talk about, specifically the United States. We are a country where it seems more so the men are more, not cowards, that's not the word, but the women, the spouses are like, let's go prearrange or let's go talk about what we want to be celebrated for and how. In the 1800s, the families did everything. And then in the 1900s, in the early 1900s, the funeral director would come to the residence and prepare the loved one and lay them out, in quotes. And then slowly the family like, well, why don't we just send them to your place to have a visitation? It's almost like the profession has taken this celebration obligation away from the family. And maybe that's what we're seeing even in the aspect of unclaimed loved ones. It's maybe voluntary at this point. Maybe we don't have to take care of our own people, even our own family. Would you all agree with that?
If people are thinking that, and we've definitely had some folks say, oh, well, you know, what does it matter? They're just, you know, why should we care about death, basically, right? I would say kind of two things immediately to that, and then I give it to Stefan. But the first is that's a rupture with not just a couple hundred years, but millennia. Like that sort of goes core to who we are as a humanity, right? So there's clear evidence from the Neolithic, Paleolithic periods that we cared for our dead, that we buried our dead, right? So this is really longstanding, and it's really more of a contemporary, in that long-term perspective, it's really more of a contemporary, you know, problem, if you will, that we've gotten so uncomfortable talking about death, right? It does unsettle people. I have a sweatshirt from the Order of the Good Death that says Future Corpse on it. And when I wear that out, I'm telling you, people stare, people comment on it. It does something to sort of shake people of this notion that, you know, oh my gosh, I don't know. Are we supposed to think about death in the middle of the day outside at the beach? You know, the second thing, and maybe, you know, there's more that you also want to say or ask about this. It's like, we can learn a lot about our society by the way we care for our dead. So it's not just the death in and of itself. It's not just the ritual for the ritual's sake. It's how do we care for the dead, and what does that say about who we are as a living? So, and also thinking, you know, we talk about this in the book, you know, what is it saying about American society that we're at this point that more and more people are going unclaimed? And at the same time, trying to say, well, when we talk about death, we're really talking about the living. That's also an opportunity to do things better in life for folks who are vulnerable than to wait until they've died, right? We've seen this flurry of government activity that organizes around people in Los Angeles who die with no family, who are cut off, who are isolated. Well, a lot of them have been living isolated for years. So what could this rising number, this attention to the unclaimed, do to help us think about some sort of intervention now in people's lives while they're still here that we could make things better.
It's like you don't want to wait for the abandonment at the moment of death. You want to really intervene in life and think about ways that people are should be connected and should focus on valuing family ties, other ties. So, you know, it's not one of the things that this book really shows us is that it's not about all the stuff you gather in life, all the stuff you squirrel away, your assets, your cars, the house, the whatever you have, the possessions. At the end, what really counts is there somebody going to show up for you when you die? And what did it say about your life if there's nobody there? I mean, nobody wakes up and grows up as a child and says, when I grow up, I want to be have such a life that there's nobody left for me to care whether I died or not. So there's something that is both a call for internal individual reflection, like what kind of life do you want to live that at least at the end of your life, there will be somebody who mourns you. And then there's something about the society. What kind of a society do we want to have that allows people to go unclaimed or that sees rising numbers of unclaimed? It's a call to action. We, as a collectivity, we need to invest in all kinds of initiatives and we need to prioritize social connections. So that in that sense, the unclaimed are like a tip of an iceberg. They give us something, very strong signal that something is awry in the way that we are disconnected and that we are estranged from one another, and that we need to turn the tide during life and not during death.
I believe that we will absolutely be remembered for something. We do leave a mark on life. We do. And in times, we've chiseled away at our self-worth. Maybe society's done it. Maybe we've done it to other people and we've done it to ourselves. Whenever you all were writing The Unclaimed and doing all this research, and I want to ask here in a moment about maybe some personal experiences too. But Pamela, what is one thing that really stands out to you that you feel just totally created a massive shift in the way you think or feel, something that inspired you, moved you during this project?
I did not expect when I decided to write a book about the unclaimed, I'd be writing about family estrangement. And I did not expect that as I was writing about family estrangement, I too would become estranged from my family. But during the course of the writing of this book, my father and I have kind of fallen out with each other and we haven't been in touch in years. And it just sort of brings home for me this notion that, you know, the idea of going unclaimed is it's closer than I think a lot of us want to realize or think about. There is so much. There are so many risk factors that cross across, you know, that kind of cut across American society that for me, I would love for people to read this book and just see, you know, maybe see themselves, maybe help them understand they're not alone if they're like me and they've struggled with family relationships. And at the same time, kind of think like going back to what Stefan said earlier, what can be a way out of this? But first, you know, before you can get out of it, you need to understand you're in it. And for me, at least, just writing this book has been really helpful in feeling not that I'm alone. And then in talking to people about the book and talking about my family experience, I know that this has been an opportunity for others to also share. And so knowing that people are hungry to have conversations, deep conversations about some things that are maybe on the surface, you know, very difficult, but the deeper we get, the more it helps us.
I want to ask, do you feel that this has been almost a sense of maybe some therapy for you as well, some healing in a very odd, profound way?
Yeah, I do think so. So at the end of the book, Stefan and I both have kind of personal reflection. And so I write about this and I hope people will read it with, you know, some grace and understanding for the stories in the book in light of what we've all, you know, what I found, what I write about. It's certainly what happened for me. You know, I kind of came into this project thinking, well, it's obvious if you have the money to claim somebody, you should. Like, of course. And as I did this book, as I wrote this book, actually, as it was, you know, the writing of these stories throughout the book, I came to realize, you know, it's just not that simple anymore. And so I developed, I think, a lot of more. I think I'm an empathetic person, but I developed even more empathy for people in this book and who are touched by this phenomenon. And that's what I would hope people would come to the book also going in with a hope that they would find and deepen their own empathy.
Stefan, what is something that you just take with you that you maybe surprise yourself in being moved by throughout this process?
Well, I also had this sense, like Pamela, that the unclaimed are other people, you know, the homeless, people who are far away. And then about a couple of years ago, I ended up with an emergency and I ended up going to the hospital. And, you know, I have two dogs and I just had to leave them behind because there was an emergency. I had to go to the hospital. And then I found out when I was in the hospital that I had to stay a couple of days and my wife happened to be abroad. And so I was going to my phone and thinking, who am I going to call to take care of the dogs? And this was a wake-up call. I mean, it's like, okay, I'm maybe not at risk of going unclaimed, but it's much, as Pamela said, it's much closer than I think. It's like, you know, the COVID pandemic has done a really bad number on, you know, social ties and friendships. And so I think this was a wake-up call to make this a priority. I too need to reach out at people, create opportunities to connect. And so what we talked about earlier, that in life is where you have to make the difference. Also what we both took away from it is like we have to be really nice to our children because they're the ones who are going to have to claim us. So, you know, it's not just like the parent generation, but it's like our kids are now, you know, we're already love them, but now we have more reasons to love them.
You just hit a point. This project, it seems, deepened your appreciation for your all's lives. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
It's beautiful. I feel like we walk through these days and nights and we experience triumph, but we experience sadness and tragedy and heaviness. And I feel that what this profession, these conversations allow and offer is an opportunity to reflect and realize who are we to think that we are privileged enough to live a life without suffering? And I believe that through suffering, there is victory and an opportunity to have a sense of perspective. Do you feel, Pamela, that your perspective, you hear everyone say, oh, perception is reality. And I find that to be lazy and surface. Yes. I think perspective is reality. Although all perspectives are different. My point and question is, do you feel that your perspective has shifted drastically throughout this process?
Yeah, I don't think it was drastic in the sense of overnight something changed, but over the course of the years, right, and the different phases of this, definitely, I'm different, I think, in mostly good ways. I think we tried to bring that to the book. It sounds sort of trite, right? Like life is short, make it matter. But that's certainly, there's a reason why people say this, you know, year after year after year. And so we kind of, you come to this book and I think over through the course of the writing, we really wanted to convey the importance of community, the importance of showing up for strangers. I mean, if you want to ask me, that's where I think I've changed the most. It's on the family front, the personal front, but it's also just trying to be a better member of the community. Coming at folks who are struggling with a lot more empathy and forgiveness and grace. I saw the people, I was so touched by the people who volunteer their time and in some cases devote their entire lives, their careers to burying strangers. And, you know, we tell the story of a woman in the book who dedicates her life, gives up a lot of her real estate practice to be able to organize funerals for abandoned babies. Because she reads a story in the newspaper about an abandoned baby. It unsettles her. She calls up the San Diego coroner, whatever happened, well, nothing, the baby's still here. What do I do about it? And next thing you know, she's organizing funerals in this way. And I think to me, that has been so inspiring for me. It is time to walk the walk, right? Not to just say and get on Twitter or whatever and post, oh, I care about the world, but to actually step up and do something about it. I mean, that's where the stories toward the latter part of the book really, I think about them all the time in my day-to-day life. What can I do to be, you know, stepping up for other people and showing up for strangers?
We do canned food drives and we collect food for the hungry because people promote that. Hey, bring your non-perishables. Maybe it's time, like you said, for people to step up and say, let's educate people on the value of celebration and life and in death, showing that they are valued and not being afraid of these conversations and wearing that shirt that you just referred to a moment ago, so to speak, on the beach and being okay with the odd looks or odd questions. I think that could be a great starting point. Stefan, do you have, and this is a personal question, but do you have your prearranged funerals because of this?
I have a will and advanced directives, and I have made very clear what I would like to have done my body, but I haven't really paid for a prenate, but I've made all those other plans. And I think this is something that is indeed necessary. If you want to have a little bit of control of what happens to your body, you need to articulate that. You need to have conversations with your loved ones. And to think about this is like to think about it, giving them a gift. So they don't have to figure it out yourself. You're helping them to what to do afterwards. So if you think about it as a gift, it's like something you do for the people who are going to be left behind. And based on what we have seen in this research, I think our bias is towards turning this into a celebration of life, not, you know, try to do this in super private, but really bringing people together and sharing the grief. Because that really, it's again another gift that you give to the people left behind, but then beyond your family to the wider community. So that's what came out of this project, is like really appreciating the value of turning this moment of potentially bringing people together at a funeral into something that's meaningful for those left behind.
In pre-planning, when you pre-arrange, you actually make 106 of the decisions long in advance, because at the loved one's death, if not pre-arranged, there's 131 plus that have to be decided. But 106 can be decided prior to the death of a loved one. It is an invaluable gift, and people think, oh, that's weird. But we plan for vacations for years. I mean, we're on Travelocity or whatever website, and we're comparing. And it's odd that we don't do the same. It's very, very unique and interesting. Pamela, I am curious, your first experience at a funeral home. Do you remember that? Can you recall back?
I mean, I grew up in a Baptist family. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was at the church. But I distinctly remember my grandfather and seeing his body and thinking, you know, that sort of, there's that closure. I mean, closure is such a weird word, but that moment where you're like, oh, this is real. Mm-hmm. And it's like the person, but it's not the person anymore. And yeah, I remember that.
It's Stefan, I have the same question for you. And then I want to go back to that. Do you remember your first experience in regards to death?
Yes. So So this was when my mother died, and I was about 22 at the time. And so this happened in Belgium, so this is not an American story. But I remember two things that stood out from this entire experience. So the first was in the funeral home itself. And so I remember my father and my mother, who had passed away, her sister, so the sister-in-law, discussing different funeral packages. And my father choosing the most expensive one to impress his sister-in-law. And I was thinking about how that just didn't feel right to me, but you know, this was not my place to make a big fuss about that. And then I also remember the actual funeral. And so I have two brothers, and they are younger than me. So there was, I was 22, my brother was 20, and the other was 18. And here we were without a mother all at once. But I remember us being dressed up for the funeral and standing shoulder to shoulder to one another. I remember having this feeling of, we're going to get through this. You know, the three of us standing there together as a team, as a family, and going through the service. And I remember we got this. The funeral itself gave me that feeling of we're here in this together. We're going to move forward with this. This is not going to break us. We're going to celebrate this life and then move forward.
This finite aspect of you seeing your loved one reposing in their casket, there is something, you know, we are people that we must see to believe. It is real. And the pandemic specifically, but over time, what we've seen in the profession is this devaluing of celebration or the visitation. Growing up Roman Catholic, you know, you had three days of visitation, then it was two, and now it's all become this same day visitation and funeral. So over time, it's just been chiseled down and chiseled down. So celebration has pretty much gone out the window. And I say that loosely in the sense of time-wise, but also from the financial aspect, right? The profession as a whole, and this kind of does coincide with that one woman who respectfully took advantage of the unclaimed and, oh, we'll just get a discounted cremation service. You know, the funeral profession, they're feelers. Funeral directors are terrible overall salespeople. That's not what they want to do. They don't want to sell you the most expensive anything. They want you to select something that you feel celebrates your loved one the most, right? I think that people have, oh, the funeral home is just trying to get the most money out of us. Everything's so expensive. You know, I guess what I mean by all that is all those factors have kind of diminished the celebration. But also going back to what you say, Stefan, is the beauty of you and your siblings shoulder to shoulder. And I have bore witness to this thousands of times. The community, yes, you all are family and brothers, but the community of you all literally physically touching over the body of your mother, who you love more than anything, who you still love and who you still think of. And together, you all not even having to speak because of what her funeral celebration afforded you all this opportunity. We are going to continue on to honor her and to love one another. There's something absolutely beautiful, and that solidifies the value of human life altogether. Big full circle. That is why what you all have spent such a long time on in this book, The Unclaimed, you're exposing and opening our eyes to humanity from multiple levels. I mean, the man that drives every Wednesday, veterans, for 50 people to show up.
I think this is actually also why organizing a service for the unclaimed is so incredibly powerful, because you have strangers coming together burying strangers, and you have nothing in common. You don't know anything about these people who are being buried. You don't know anything about the people surrounding you, but you share this moment of bringing dignity and humanity to people just because they are humans. That's the only thing that's there. And I think that makes it so extraordinarily important to recognize and bring dignity to the death of people who are unclaimed. Even if their family is no longer interested in organizing a funeral, we as a community can come together and stand around the graveside and celebrate their lives.
What is your hope, Stefan? Pamela touched on this. What is your ultimate hope with The Unclaimed when people read it? What's your hope?
My hope is that people think about their own lives and take stock of it and decide, this is where I want to go. These are the connections that are going to matter. Because the question that The Unclaimed posed to each one of us is like, who's going to be there for you when you pass away? Who's going to mourn you? So I think that's on a personal level. And then on a collective level is like, who are we going to be as a society? Who is going to be there for the people who are inevitably going unclaimed? And what can we do in their lives so that they don't, that we have fewer unclaimed? What kind of coming together, what kind of social programs can we support in order to make unclaimed the rare exception rather than what it's becoming now, more and more common?
Pamela, I believe that death makes us bitter or it makes us better, but also has this opportunity to show that human beings, we hear a lot of bad about people, but we're actually really decent. And you've seen that through your all's research. And I want to know, when the book closes on your life, Pamela, what do you want to be remembered for?
The unclaimed, the book, no.
That's amazing.
I would like to be known as a writer, but I think more generally, you know, it's back to what Stefan said. It's about the relationships that, you know, I had. Did I make a positive impact on my daughter's life, on friends' lives, on, you know, students? I'm a teacher, and so I think of my impact there, and I want to know that, you know, I'm putting more good into the world than bad. I'm not a perfect person, and I have my flaws for sure. But overall, I'm trying. Yeah.
Stefan, what do you wish to be remembered for?
I want to also be remembered for the mentoring I did of students, how I made a difference in their life, how I make a difference and had been a good father, good partner in relationships. One of the things that we really got out of this book is, like, we're so misguided by trying to pursue all these riches. You cannot take them with you, but you live on in the memories of other people. Like, one of the things we say in the book is that you actually end up dying twice. You die once when you physically die, and then you die a second time when the last person remembers your name. And I think what distinguishes us on a fundamental level is, how long will it take before that remembrance is gone? And eventually it will, it's inevitable that it probably will be gone. I mean, with very few exceptions, we remember the 8 billion people who lived before us. But some people already are forgotten before they even physically die. And so that's what we want to avoid. You want to live on in the memories of others in a positive way.
You saying that when we stop talking about someone, I make it a point, and this might seem very odd to some people, but if you have never walked the grounds of a cemetery, the driveways, like, especially if you want to get a good workout, like if you want to work your legs and get your core going, you go up and down the hills and so forth. But the beauty of that space, because it's has this sense of holiness about it, but you find yourself just gazing and seeing the names of the loved ones on these monuments and the lives, you start thinking about the lives that they lived and the people who do love them. Maybe the people that forgot them, but in that moment, a total stranger, Nathan, acknowledged their existence. And that's something I try to make a point to do very frequently. And that's something that I hope that if I can, you know, help in that regard, that's what I try to do as well. But it does, you all talking about this book, The Unclaimed, and all of the different ways to stand up and to stop saying, hey, we need to do something, but not doing anything. It makes me want to do more as well. And I appreciate that. And for people who wish to read this book, theunclaimedbook.com, they're able to give their own personal experiences, right, to share that at the website. This is a very serious, more so serious topic and conversation. And so a lot of what we've discussed is more on your seriousness. But I always wonder, you know, you all, two brilliant individuals, when you're writing this over the course of, how long did it take you all to put this book together?
8 years altogether.
8 years. So, Stefan, first, so over the 8 years, you have to tell me a funny, humorous, like, I wrote this chapter while, is there a place and space where you would go and reflect and start to dive in? Or is there something funny that you have as a way to get going?
The way I work is that I get very excited, start writing, and then get stuck. And it's super frustrating. It's super frustrating because I want the words on paper, but then I need to just let it percolate. I need to go on a bike ride, walk the dogs, and then at some point it will come true. And again, I get very excited, right. and then I get stuck again. So it's this up and down of excitement. And I need to have the right music. Pamela made me addicted to coffee, so now I need to have coffee too. I also need to I need to write in the morning. That's definitely part of the entire enterprise.
That's your most productive time is in the morning.
Yeah.
That's mine as well. Yeah. If after any really serious decisions after noon, the might as well just go out the window. Right. Yeah.
No, I actually mapped this. So I wrote down how I was feeling every half an hour over an entire day. And it was very obvious that I started very high and then I start to dip a little bit. And then after lunch, it goes really down and I have a little bit of a peak around 4 o'clock. But then by 6 o'clock, it's like, forget it. I can barely put two sentences together.
That's amazing. I love it. I don't feel alone anymore. Pamela, what is something that you found yourself doing over the course of 8 years? Obviously, well, hopefully you aren't someone who's impatient. Because 8 years is not a short time.
Might take a little bit of impatience to actually finish it at some point.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of the similar things, you know, walk. At some point, though, I realized I kind of can't write with music on in the same way. But I do like to have a little dance party here and there where I just get up and shake loose and let it go and hope that the thoughts come back to me. And then sometimes I just escape. I just need to get on a train. If I'm in Amsterdam, get on a train and go somewhere and just get a change of scene and remember that, you know, life does go on.
And you probably got into the loop, I'm sure, at times. 8 years, this is your lives. I mean, eight years of your life, I should say. But my gosh, and a lot happens in 8 years and it's a short time, but it's a long time. And there's so many more questions as far as there's probably an element of excitement in releasing your infant child into the world, but there's also this maybe a grieving process even to a degree. And all of that, because of all of that, as someone who is a creative, as someone who doesn't feel alive, and I really mean that, perhaps that strikes a chord for you, I don't feel alive if I'm not creating. If I am not writing a song or doing something like this, my purpose or sense of it, it's hard for me to find it. Stefan, you were going to say something.
With the unclaimed, so I think I'm the same way. I need to be writing, and Pamela is the same way too. We need to be writing because otherwise something is missing in our lives. But when you're studying the unclaimed, or when you're writing about the unclaimed, there's also a sense of responsibility. These are people who are invisible in life. They're abundant at that. So for us to go and dig into their lives, it comes with a responsibility to do justice to their stories and to bring them into the open. And we chose those four people carefully, but we didn't know their full lives. And then we started digging into them. They were all fascinating. And so every year, Los Angeles County buries about 1,600 to 2,000 people. And so you cannot stop but wondering, what kind of stories are we burying? What kind of stories are untold here? So there's also a sense of responsibility. There's a gravity to this topic that it's a privilege to be able to tell their stories, but it comes with a responsibility. You better do a good job because there's something there that they deserve it. They have been so marginalized. They deserve that we give it our best effort.
I believe that this book, The Unclaimed, I think that this world is about you, generally speaking, over self. And we have a selfish tendency, generally, naturally. I don't think it's a bad thing or good thing, but I do believe that over time we might become more selfish. And all that to say, I believe that the last 8 years of your all's lives devoting to a topic and subject and now a book that has never been touched upon, I can't think of a more selfless act than opening eyes to the decency of humans, the value of life. And, you know, you said, I asked, what do you want to be remembered for? And Pamela, you joked, but I want you to know as a genuine new fan and appreciator of what you all have done and are doing to raise awareness for this, I think that's what will happen. And I want to say thank you all thank you so much for that. And it means so much to me for you to show up for the marginalized and those who didn't have a voice or didn't have an opportunity to perhaps in life be much or what they thought they could have been.
Thank you for having us and letting us get a chance to communicate and tell folks about the book.
Thank you for all the good work you're doing yourself.
The Unclaimed, Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels. Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmermans, thank you. Thank you for devoting your time, your talents to educating us and for giving those a voice who deserve it. This is YDT. Be sure to check out theunclaimedbook.com. Grab you a copy wherever it is you purchase or listen to books like you listen to this podcast. Thank you for listening. Check out the show notes. All the links will be available there. Until next time, take care of yourselves. You are loved far more than you could ever know.